to her words. It's called flooding for a reason. You need to be inundated with the stimulus that causes your fear in order to get over it. I understand that, but I need some time. You don't have time. You've got a performance in 2 weeks, and you haven't even picked up a violin in over a decade. If I were you, I'd be a lot more worried about that than some silly cameras. Well, you're not me, I snap. I'm the only me there is. So you wouldn't understand why this is important, and I don't want to hear how many stupid degrees you have. You're not me. I'm going to hang up now, she says. And if you call again, it better be to quit. I open my mouth to say something, but I get 3 short beeps, letting me know the call has ended. Bitch! I yell to the ceiling, and then I throw the phone down on the floor, and the screen shatters into 1 million little spider webs. Fuck, I mutter, reaching over to pick it up. Fuck. It's still working, miraculously, but it's useless. Because even though I try to hit that little phone icon like 70 billion times, the screen is cracked so bad the touch won't register. I guess I just have to quit then. I can't stay here without a phone. What time is it? 1 in the afternoon? Maybe? I think this through rationally. If I wait until dark, I can probably, I don't know, walk home? Jesus, how far away am I from my building? It took about 20 minutes to get here, so miles away. But if the reward at the end of the night was being back at home, locked up tight in my own apartment, I could do it. I could call the concierge at my building at a... Fuck. There are no phone booths these days. But if I could find a phone in the house... Yes. There has to be a phone in this house. What kind of mansion has no landline, right? Surely there's one tucked away in an office or something. I could call the building, ask the concierge to have a car come pick me up. I'll need the address. I don't even have the address. I think I could manage a trip outside to get the street and house number, though. Yes. That's exactly what I'll do. Wait until dark, go outside, get the address, come back in, find a phone, call the concierge, have him send a car, and go the fuck home. There's a few holes in that plan. Like, what if there's no phone here? If that happens and I wait until dark, then I really will have to walk. And I don't even know this city. I haven't been more than a few blocks from my apartment since I moved in. I could get lost and end up having to ask a stranger for directions. I might be so lost I don't get home before dawn. Then I'll be outside in the light, lost, and probably losing my mind. I should check the house for a phone first, then call the concierge immediately, tell him what I need, and that the car can come as soon as it gets dark. Perfect. I stand up and straighten myself out. I'm still wearing my winter coat, so my whole body is covered in sweat because this bathroom is small and the heat is blasting out of the vents. I take it off and say, "You can do this." So I reach for the doorknob and pull it open, confident I will enact this plan and be home soon. This whole nightmare behind me. It's quiet when I peek out, and empty, and not well lit because it's cloudy outside. I creep forward along the hallway, back towards the front door, glancing all around me just trying to get my bearings, and find myself in a wide living area. I search for a phone, and in doing so, look up and gasp at the beauty on the ceiling. They're coffered, but not in the typical box pattern. It's rectangles and quarter circles with an intricate hand-painted design that goes perfectly with the Italianate exterior. Quite striking. The room is long, like a ballroom where people throw parties. There are several sitting areas, a floor-to-ceiling fireplace with woodwork as elaborate as the coffered ceiling, and gorgeous side tables with lamps. Several windows are tall arches with fancy trim, but others are rectangles and have long, overflowing sheer curtains that sweep along the inlaid hardwood floor. I stand there admiring the entire presentation, picturing parties. Maybe even a string quartet over there in that corner by the arched windows, and the 2 credenzas on either side of the fireplace filled with food, triple-tiered trays of sweets and platters of finger food, and punch bowls, the kind that have ice cream floating in them, perhaps. Jesus Christ, I mutter. Focus, Evangeline. That's the dream of a child, and you're not a stupid child. I look up again, but this time my eyes skim past the decorated ceiling and land on the cameras. Whoever put these up didn't bother to hide them. They're mounted on the walls. There's one on the mantel and two pointed at each of the double French doors that open into other rooms. One of which is pointed right at me. "I hope you got a good look," I growl, moving along the hallway. "Because I'm out of here tonight." There was no phone in that room, but up ahead is a kitchen. If people are going to have a landline these days, they'd put it in the kitchen. And for some reason, that makes me think of how it must have been before phones were portable and could fit in your pocket. In old movies, there was one phone in a house, and it was either in some special phone niche in a hallway or in the kitchen. So yes, the kitchen. I move forward into it and stop, once again taken aback at the beauty of this place. It's white and gray and light blue, which sounds a little bit boring, but it isn't. There's a huge farm sink, huge one, and I know they're trendy today. I watch a shitload of HGTV. But as I get closer and notice the small chips in the enamel, I realize it is, in fact, made of cast iron underneath that white enamel. I get the feeling this sink is as old as the house itself. It's a modern kitchen in all other ways. Many shades of blue glass tiles on the backsplash, white marble countertops, black soapstone on the island, and stainless steel appliances. The stove has a million burners on it with those fancy red knobs that let everyone know you overpaid for that thing and probably don't know how to use it. Painted cabinets. Not traditional white as one might expect, but a dark gray color that warms the place up and makes it feel homey. I scan the room for a phone as I make my way around the large center island, but once again come up empty. The office, I decide. I stumbled into an office in my panic to find the powder room. That's where I head next. The hallway continues, like all the rooms branch off this corridor. It's not completely closed in, which bothers me. If this were my place, I'd wall up all these French doorways that lead back to the kitchen and living room. Open concept isn't for everyone, after all. It's not my place, I gently remind myself. You're only going to be here for a few more hours, so stop playing fixer-upper, you dingbat. A smile creeps over my face at my internal monologue. It is a beautiful house, though. Like, if I were to ever sell the penthouse, I could see myself living in a house like this. It's got a wall and a gate, and I bet the backyard is also surrounded by those thick, high hedges that give you a sense of privacy in the city. The next set of double doors are closed, so I pull them open at the same time and find myself staring at a library. Shelves and shelves and more shelves of books. Two soft, butter-yellow velvet couches face each other in the middle of the gigantic room, and there's a light gray upholstered ottoman that spans almost the entire space between them, with glossy magazines sitting in a neat pile on top of a tray. I get lost in this room for just a moment. Allow myself to appreciate how beautiful it is. Wonder what it would be like to sit on those velvety cushions and read a book on a wintry afternoon, just like this one, free of all the worry and panic and fear. But that all stops the second I see what's propped up in the far corner near a bright window, and I think I forget how to breathe.
Chapter 9. Ixion. She creeps out of the powder room like a frightened mouse, or a small child making her way through a haunted house, knowing someone is going to jump out at her, just not when. I never liked haunted houses. I don't see the point in knowingly scaring the fuck out of yourself, acting like a dumbass the entire time you're in there, and then patting yourself on the back when you come out because what? You made it through fake shit, screaming like it's real, and didn't die when it was over? Please. There's enough real scary shit in the world to go around 10 times. No one needs to make it up. Society is really on a downward spiral, if you ask me. Making it through a haunted house is the kind of stuff we're calling courage these days. Movement on the large screen in the middle of my semicircular control panel brings my attention back to Evangeline. She's inching her way down the hall, going so fucking slow I just want to turn on the microphones and scream at her to hurry the fuck up. I mean, how slow can a person walk? How timid can one woman be? A momentary flash of shame washes through me, because I know damn well how timid women can be. And why. She glances up at one of the hallway cameras just as I think that thought, eyes still covered by her ridiculous dark sunglasses, cheeks blotchy red, sweat pooled on her upper lip. I place my hands on the console table and lean in to see her better. Jesus Christ. She's almost hyperventilating. Her chest is rising and falling so fast she must be making herself dizzy. She lowers her gaze and continues to inch down the hallway until she's standing in the open double doors of the main ballroom, which has been turned into sort of a grand receiving area. My family home has one of each. The ballroom is empty most of the time. Just a sad, open room with extravagant wood floors and tall rectangle windows with sheer curtains, much like these, that pool down onto the floor and always made me think of how much dust they must collect. And our receiving area looks more like a men's club than a living area. Large wingback chairs upholstered in soft leather and seams held together by large brass nail heads. This house is smaller than ours. And really, who needs a ballroom? So Jordan, or whoever the fuck owns this place, has turned it into a formal living area. A place to talk with guests and be served afternoon tea, and just generally be ostentatious. She scans the room, looking for something, but then gets distracted by the ceiling. I don't blame her for that. It's a nice ceiling. But a few moments later, she snaps out of her awe when she finds the cameras. She mumbles something which I can't understand and will have to replay later, and then moves on towards the kitchen. Same shit in there. She looks around, perhaps impressed, perhaps not. I mean, she is Evangeline Rolain, right? I think this is a pretty cool mansion, but doesn't impress me? Are you fucking kidding? This might as well be the children's playhouse compared to what I grew up in. She was quite the little worldly globetrotter as a child. She played for Saudi princes and the Queen of England. I bet she's seen her share of swank. But she touches things in there. The red knobs of the stove. The smooth, cold countertops. The dark gray cabinet doors. Perhaps picturing herself living here. Or maybe comparing this place with hers. The way I'm doing with my own family dwelling. She looks around again. Like she's searching for something, then backs out into the hallway like she's reluctant to leave. I wonder if she cooks. It's been a long time since I had a home-cooked meal. I literally cannot remember the last time I didn't grab food from the restaurant. Her steps are quicker now, still tentative, but less so than before she entered the kitchen. And that's when she stops. My smile is automatic, because this will be the room she falls in love with. She reaches for the double doors, pulls them both open at the same time, and then, stunned silence, as she takes it all in, and then, she sees what I've been wanting her to see since I first discovered it myself. I grin, wide. Because I was right. This room will. She walks in, hand over her chest, that terrible fast breathing making her sound like a panting dog, and stops next to a yellow velvet couch, reaching for it, like she might fall over. Can it? But that's all I catch, as she begins to mumble out a constant stream of words. She rushes towards the violin in the corner. It's a beautiful violin, soft, subtle shades of red, ebony black knobs. The strings look silver in the dim light filtering through the long, sheer curtains. She gets about a foot away and stops, her head shaking back and forth. No, that shake says. No. And then she backs away from the instrument. She trips over the rug, bumps into the arm of a couch, and falls to the floor. No, that's not what happens. She crumples to the floor. I lean in again, trying to see more than the camera allows. What the fuck are you doing? I ask the screen. It only takes me a second to realize she's crying. This chick is seriously disturbed. Flat out fucking crazy. I sit down in my chair to watch, because that's my job, and grab a pen and piece of paper, sitting off to the side for notes. Jordan didn't ask for notes, but it's just part of my process. I'm not normally so uninvolved in the surveillance process. I typically work with husbands, or wives who think their wives, or husbands, are cheating on them. Occasionally I work for parents concerned about a teenager, or some rural sheriff's department that doesn't have the right resources, which was how I ended up in Wyoming last month and just never left. And even side jobs get notes. That's the least I can do for those women. Why do you do it? Jordan asked me that a couple years ago. He called me on Christmas. Why? I have no idea. We hadn't talked in years. No one died, nothing to report, just a fucking out-of-the-blue phone call. You've got more money than God. You could buy any house you want. Hell, dozens of them. Get a fucking yacht, private jet, and if there's such a thing yet, a spot on the next space shuttle to the moon or Mars or wherever the fuck people book tickets for in space. My answer? There's no space shuttle anymore. To which Jordan responded with a grunt. And that was the end of that. He hung up and never called back. Nope, he just showed up to bail me out of jail a couple weeks ago. Because he needed you, that nasty voice in my head says. I rationalize that internal suspicion. Cameras and shit, I'm just kind of good at it. I don't have to think about it. I know where to put them, how to set up a control room, how to keep busy as you watch so you don't get bored. I have regular cameras too, with those long zoom lenses. Sometimes I just sit in a car or a van or a fucking U-Haul and take pictures. And I like compiling data. My clients don't ask for it, but I give them all a little report at the end. Assign motive to certain actions. Put pictures in chronological order so they make sense. And bind it all up with brass brads and a plastic cover sheet with their case number on it. Plus a coupon for 10% off their next order. It's got little dotted lines and a miniature pair of scissors around the words, letting them know they should cut it out and present it to me. They never do that. But I try. My phone buzzes on the console table next to me. I glance down at the screen, which says, number unavailable, and answer out of sheer curiosity alone. Yeah? I say. X, the woman says on the other end of the line. Who's this? I ask back.
Shella.
She laughs.
Remember? I saw you the other day and—
How'd you get my number?
Jordan. But that's not why I'm calling. I'm having this thing next month.
Thing? I ask.
Yeah, I told you I own that tea room next to the place that used to be the club.
Right.
Well, I'm having a thing and you're coming. We should catch up.
Nah, I say, my eyes darting back to Evangeline on the screen. She still hasn't moved.
Good,
she says. Like I just said yes instead of no.
It's Saturday, February 14th at 3 o'clock.
Isn't that Valentine's Day?
Right. Bring your lady friend, okay? She's so interesting and I'd really like to meet her.
Shella, I'm fucking working. I can't go to your thing. And she's not my lady friend. She's my fucking client. Which isn't really true. Jordan is my client. But I don't have another word for her.
I'd love to hear her play. Can she bring her violin?
She doesn't like people watching her. She won't even go outside, okay? There's no way in hell she's going to show up at your tea party.
Perfect,
Shella says.
See you then.
I just stare at the phone once the call ends. That chick is fucking weird. I'm not going to her thing. Even if I wasn't working, I wouldn't go. Shella and Jordan and the city and fucking childhood bullshit. I mean, I haven't seen Shella Walcott, Baldwin, whatever, since she was like 9 years old. And now she's suddenly calling me up like we're old friends. We weren't old friends. She disappeared to wherever the fuck her crazy parents took her, and I got left with Jordan, and... Fuck! Why the hell did I take this job? Because Jordan bailed me out of jail, I rationalize. But that's not even true. I didn't need bail money. I didn't call him for help. And if I'm being totally honest here, I would have stayed in that cell until my court appearance, then pled guilty and happily served my time. It would have been like a vacation to me. Because you've got nothing better to do, Ixion. That's why. Yes. That right there is the truth. I have absolutely nothing better to do than sit in this stupid basement and watch some psycho fall apart because people might look at her. Of all the stupid things I've heard in this life, this is right up there with, I deeply apologize for my inappropriate actions and I'm seeking treatment for my sex addiction. I stare at the screen. willing her to get up and do something so I can stop thinking about my life and go back to feeling sorry for someone else. The minutes tick off. She stays there, all crumpled up on the rug, playing with a string or a piece of lint or whatever the fuck she's rolling between her fingers. And she's chanting something, like a poem or a song or something like that. I can't really hear it. The microphones in that room aren't the best. And I try to find a good angle to see her lips to try to read them as she mumbles. But it's no use. Her long hair is mostly covering her face.
I'm a bird in a song. And the wind.
Fuck, I don't know what she's saying. It's a nursery rhyme, maybe? Eventually, she stops playing with the lint ball and her lips stop moving, so the chant is over. And then one side of her stupid sunglasses fall away from her face, and I see that she's sleeping. Guess I won that bet, right? Too bad there wasn't money riding on it. Like I need the money. Like the bet was with someone other than myself. Like, I really need to get out more. Sometime over the next several hours, she rolls over and grabs for a blanket draped over the arm of a couch and tries to cover herself. It's one of those blankets that aren't good for anything. They're usually too thin and too short and too decorative to have any useful purpose whatsoever. My mother used to have those things on all our couches when I was a kid. It annoyed me, even back when I was short, that they never covered enough to get me warm. And then I started wondering if she's cold. Of course she's cold. She's sleeping in a giant mansion that can't ever be warm enough because that's the way of mansions. And she's on the floor. And that blanket doesn't even qualify as a blanket, so I press the button for the microphone in that room, and I lean in, ready to tell her to get the fuck up and go to sleep in a real bed because, you know, there's like 27 different things to sleep on in this place, and none of them involve the floor, and I stop just in time. Because I'm under strict orders not to talk to her. And if I do talk to her, she'll know I'm a man, and she'll freak the fuck out, and then she'll walk out of here and call the therapist or whatever, and then fucking jig is up, right? Ixion and Jordan do what they do best. Fuck people up. I don't know where that just came from, so I glance over at the notebook, then notice I'm still fucking holding the pen in my right hand, and I'll just write her a note, and quietly make my way up to the library, and place it next to her, and then kick her or something, so she wakes up and finds it. Good plan, X. So I turn the page in the notebook, and think about how to put this. You're being dumb. Go to bed. Probably not the best way to handle it. So I flip the page and try again. Turn up the heat. But there's like 6 or 7 thermostats in this house. That might just confuse her. You haven't seen the master bedroom yet. It's very nice. Go sleep there. That conjures up a lot of innuendo. You're cold. Go upstairs. Find the master bedroom. Get in the bed, cover up, and go to sleep. There we go. That's the winner. I fold it in half. Write her name on the front. Get up. Leave the control room. Make my way upstairs. And walk down the hallway to the library. It's weird to see her in person after watching her all day. Her body is contorted into some semblance of a fetal position. And the blanket is diagonal across her upper body because that's the only way it's big enough to cover anything. And whoever the fuck came up with decorative blankets needs to spend the night in this cold-ass mansion on the floor trying to use one. And she's shivering. I enter the room as quietly as I can, wishing I wasn't wearing boots, acutely aware that the hardwood floors are ancient and most of the boards are creaking. But I manage, because that's how I roll, place the folded piece of paper right next to her softly breathing mouth. And back out the way I came.
Chapter 10. Evangeline. I dream of birds and summer days. I string together words in books that earn me praise. But the words are notes, and the books are songs, and the birds and summer days are gone. The winter wind is strong and sounds like the missing music I lost and found. I wake up, confused, still hearing birds, still thinking it's summer, but I am chilled to the bone and shaking in my core, and the winter wind is blowing outside with force. And then I remember where I am, what I'm doing, and why the fuck are there birds in this house? My sunglasses are all askew on my face, so when I open my eyes in the darkness, I can see a little more than I'd be able to had they been affixed properly. The library, I remind myself. I glance at the corner where the violin is propped up on the stand. The sun has set, and there's just a faint glow of light coming through the window, outlining it, as if I needed it outlined. The song of birds is coming from a speaker somewhere. I look up and find all the cameras, then quickly straighten out my sunglasses to hide my eyes. But that just sucks all the remaining light out of the room, blinding me. Pushing up from the floor, I get dizzy. So I stay on all fours and hang my head for a few moments, staring down at the pattern on the rug. It's an ancient rug. Like a real ancient Persian fucking rug. I can feel the bare threads under my fingertips, the softness of the wool it's woven of. And that's when I see the note. "Evangeline," it says, written in neat print and all caps. And there's a little squiggly line underneath the letters that looks like a fancy, elongated, cursive, lowercase e, but it isn't an e. It's just a fancy little squiggly line. I look up at the nearest camera again and say, "What's this?" I'm not expecting an answer, and it never comes, so I just sit up better so my legs are underneath me. I straighten out my sweater. The second the thin blanket falls down from my shoulders, I shiver with cold. But the cold can wait. My watcher has sent me a message. Is this part of the treatment? I don't think so. And I don't care. When was the last time someone sent me a letter? I can't even recall. I was a child, probably. It was a fan. Or one of the many perverts who used to stalk me online and after performances. "Read it," my mind screams. "Open it and read it." My fingers are so nearly numb, they fumble with the folded sheet of thick paper. It's nice paper, I realize, as I manage to open it up. "You're cold. Go upstairs. Find the master bedroom. Get in the bed, cover up, and go to sleep." One fact and five commands. Just as that thought leaves my head, the birds stop singing. I think about that for a little while, unexpectedly reflective about the loss of music. My heart is racing, but not too bad, which surprises me. "You're cold." I'm chilled so bad, all I really want is to be at home taking a hot bath in my giant private tub. But that's not going to happen. Not while I'm here, at least. There are cameras up there. In all the rooms, even the bathrooms. That much I know. "Go upstairs. Find the master bedroom, get in the bed, cover up, and go to sleep." It's the answer I'm looking for. Simple, direct, obtainable. I push up from the floor, still clutching the note in my hand, and exhale. It's dark now. I could leave, find a phone somewhere, call the concierge and go home. But it all sounds like so much effort. I look at the note again and sigh. That all sounds so easy. So I do what I'm told. I leave the library, closing the double doors behind me so I don't have to see that stupid violin again should I wander down this way tomorrow, and walk down the dark hallway until I come back to the grand foyer. I stand there, looking up, the wide staircase beckoning me like an old friend. I go to it, heeding the call, and place my hand on the smoothly polished wood of the banister, still looking up as I climb, wondering if my watcher is waiting for me up there. And unexpected heat rises from my lower stomach, a stirring between my legs as I picture him. Maybe it's a her? No, the printing was very masculine. What if he is old, and Lucinda was lying? What if he's not? It doesn't matter, because when I get to the top of the stairs, he's not there. I look left and right. Nothing but closed doors in both directions. There's another staircase at the end of the hall to my left. Is he in the attic? Did he mean for me to go up to the third floor? "Find the master bedroom," was his next command. So I do that. I open the first door and find a bathroom, then notice a little red blinking light in a plug and wonder how hidden his cameras are. If it wasn't dark, I probably wouldn't notice that red light. I'd think that was just a useful adapter for my phone. I close the door and go to the next. A bedroom, but small and decorated for a small princess, so not the master. And then another, a nursery. And another, a teen room. And another bathroom. Then more bedrooms, but none are what I've been assigned to find. So I turn back, pass the grand staircase again, and head towards the second set of stairs. I pass several doors, but they are closets, and one is a bathroom. And another bedroom, still too small to be a master in this size house. I stand at the bottom of the second staircase and look up into darkness. Is he up there? Is he waiting for me? What's that noise? I crane my neck forward, head tilted, desperate to hear more. Birds. I climb without thinking. This is where I'm supposed to go. And even though I have this tiny, niggling thought that this whole fucking setup is dangerous and stupid, I don't care. I just want to hear the song again. At the top, there's a small landing. The darkness is complete. So much so, I have to inch forward and feel for the doors I know must be there. I find a knob, then a second, and realize they are double doors, just like the ones downstairs. I turn both knobs and push them inward and find a softly lit bedroom. The master. There's only one small light, and it barely counts as a light, and it's shaped like a quarter moon. More like one of those decorative things you place in a baby's nursery to give off the glow of comfort. But it's just enough for me to see everything. The bed has been turned down. The comforter is either white or pale yellow or cream. Can't really tell. But it looks soft and inviting. Did he do this for me? Turn the bed down? Or was that Lucinda? Was she in here? Did the watcher know she came and got the room ready, so he told me to come upstairs? Did Lucinda tell him to write that note? I deflate at that thought. It's an unexpected sigh of sadness to even think about it. I don't want her to be responsible for this turn of events. I want it to be him. His easy commands, his firm expectations, and not her just playing mother with me. I don't need another mother. One was more than enough, thank you. There's a camera in the corner facing the bed. In fact, I count six total. Each of the four corners, one on the fireplace mantel at the foot of the bed, and one directly above the bed in the form of a reflective black bulb among white ones nestled in the intricate chandelier. Get in bed, cover up, and go to sleep. I walk towards it, curious about the room and the dark doorway that must lead to the ensuite bathroom, but wanting to follow directions, I push that curiosity aside and kick off my shoes. The rug underneath my feet is soft sheepskin. My toes wriggle, eager to feel it on my bare skin, so I pull off my socks and give them that luxury. I feel like I suddenly have a lot to say. A million questions. What song is this? What kind of bird? It sounds familiar. Like something in a dream. Which is probably why you were dreaming poetry, Evangeline. Right. Because that's all I do these days. Dream. I kneel on the bed, feeling it give with my weight, and then crawl in, fully clothed, minus socks. The sheets are cold, but they warm quickly. I pull the heavy comforter over me and bury my face in the pillow. Something leaves me in this moment. Something not worth keeping, I think. It's dread, maybe. Or anxiety. Or fear. Maybe it's fear. Or, I think, maybe it's something returning and not leaving. Maybe it's curiosity. When was the last time I was curious about a person? Or anything? And the recordings of child prodigies don't count. Because I know why I was doing that now. That was the very first thing Lucinda and I worked out. I wanted to feel safe in their failures so I didn't judge myself too harshly. Almost all of them had trouble as adults. Most of them stopped playing just like me. They made me feel like a statistic. I wanted to feel like a statistic. When I finally said all that out loud, Lucinda smiled at me and said, "How does it feel to be reduced to a number?" That was the first time I really thought about why I had this fear of being watched. "Not good," I said back. I felt very used, honestly. like I was nothing but a fulfilled expectation. I'd worked that out as a teenager, too. I remember feeling used, voicing that feeling to my parents, and I remember their reaction, and what my father said next, how I agreed and did what he asked, let him use me again, and then when it came right down to it, I didn't. I refused. I took a step away, a step forward. I fixed things, made them better. But then why did everything get worse? Fuck, let it go. Anyway, when I called up my old agent and told her to schedule the performance, Lucinda said, "How does it feel to want something?" "Exciting," I said. "And scary. Mostly scary." And now I know why. Because it was a lie. She was right. I was never going to go through with it. That's why I was getting worse instead of better. I needed an excuse to back out. But then every time I thought about backing out, I just wanted to vomit. The birds are suddenly gone, the room quiet. And then the light on the bedside table, the soft one lighting up a porcelain moon that absolutely belongs in a child's bedroom, dims and then darkens, like it was on a timer. Maybe my whole life is on a timer and now it's over? I close my eyes and force myself to stop thinking, listen to the winter wind outside the windows of this stranger's bedroom, and pretend I hear a whisper in its blowing gale. The wind says, "Good night."
Chapter 11. Ixion. To call myself mesmerized at how the evening plays out would be an understatement. Once I decided on the substance of the note and placed it next to her sleeping body in the library, I went up to the third floor and pulled back the bed covers. I found the little moon nightlight in the nursery and set the timer for 90 minutes, which was as long as it would set to. I got a little lost in the family who no longer lives here. Who were they? Where did they go? Who owns the house? And how the hell are the two of us in here playing this sick little game without them knowing? Objecting. I made a note to ask Jordan about it the next time we talked, knowing I'd never get that answer. For all I know, this is his house. Maybe he has a family. Maybe he sent them all off on vacation until his little experiment was over. How the hell would I know? I haven't really talked to him in years. Why the hell do I care? I convinced myself I don't care. And then I went back down to my basement control room, searched the internet for recordings of songbirds, pumped one through the library speakers at a soft volume, and made myself comfortable while I waited her out. Her little poem, or whatever it was, gave me that idea. She was mumbling something about bird songs, and shivering so hard when she woke up I had an urge to leave and turn up the heat. Not that I had any better idea of which areas all the specific thermostats control, because I didn't. This room was warm from the hum of technology. I could have used some AC down here, to be honest. Now that the spell is over and she's either asleep or very good at faking it, I am realizing just how fucking strange all this is. This woman and I are alone in this house for, well, until she fucking calls it quits, I suppose. And I've already broken just about every rule I was given. I left the basement. I made contact with her. Shit, more than contact. I gave her directions. Orders, maybe. And she followed them. Is she so lost that a stranger's commands are better than making up her own mind? Huh, I say out loud. I guess it's not that unusual. Which makes me wonder what she'll do tomorrow. She could leave, walk out that door and call her therapist. Tell her everything I did. I might have even fucked her up worse than she is. Because let's face it, this chick has issues. Then there was that fucking rhyme she was chanting. What was that? I'm so damn curious, I do a search on the internet. Birds and wind poem. Birds and wind nursery rhyme. Birds and wind songs. Nothing. And then there's the violin. It seemed to make her wilt. I didn't expect that. She's an accomplished violinist, so one would naturally assume she loves the instrument and would find it comforting. Except it seemed to have the opposite effect. Fuck it, I mumbled to myself. She's a nut job. I got her to stay a night. Big deal. I don't even know how much I'm getting paid. I don't even care. I don't even know why I'm here. I do a search for her now, convinced I missed something the last time I searched. Evangeline Rolane comes right up on Wikipedia. It's long enough. Childhood, parents, first performance at age 4, then a complete list of them in chronological order. But it's the section on child prodigies, in the internal link that phrase points to, in fact, that consumes me well past midnight. I get lost in it. The weirdness of them. The claim by alternative types that these kids are just reliving past lives. The fact that almost all of them dealt with some sort of mental breakdown in their teens and 20s. Evangeline is 28 now, so yeah, fits. Then I get consumed by an image search. Pictures of her as a small girl, then growing up. All of which showcase her prominently with her violin. There is no trace of a smile after age 8. I contrast her upbringing with my own. She wasn't born to a rich family, but she was so young when their fortune changed she might as well have been. And all that money came from her. Like those child actors that score a big role and the whole family suddenly goes from dirt poor Alabama to swanky rich and famous Beverly Hills. It's a little unnatural. Not the money, but the illusion that you are important. Shit like that is a mindfuck because no one's important to anyone unless there's some sort of relationship involved. And the relationship her parents were forging with elite insiders was one of mutual gain. Take the gain away and the relationship goes with it. This plays out in every economic status. People just see it less when they're not in the top 1%. For example, you get a new used car, so you don't have to take the bus to work like most of your other coworkers. Bam. You find new friends based on your ability to give them a ride. Something they want and need. Yes, people use you like this. Almost all of them, in fact. People are assholes like that. They like you for what you have, not who you are. I can imagine the scenarios her parents went through as they climbed the social ladder. She needed an agent, and after her first performance at age 4, I'm sure they came crawling out of the woodwork. It was probably a little battle as her parents negotiated what they needed versus what they had. More appearances and money went up against a little girl with God-given talent. Once the agent was secured, they needed more access to even more influential people to keep what they just got. The cycle continued. Family rose on the shoulders of little Evangeline. The money poured in as her talent grew. Her face was everywhere. Her talent undeniable. Her youth intoxicating until the vultures who only wanted her for what she could give them became flocks circling overhead waiting for her to die. It was only a matter of time before what they saw down below was exhausted, and they took their final meal. And she broke. She was too young to know why. She was too innocent to understand how. She was too trusting to rebel until she wasn't. The court records for her emancipation are fascinating. Since she was petitioning for adult status, they were never sealed. It's a simple public records search that gives me more insight into her psyche than should be allowed. I feel a little dirty just reading them. But I can't stop. After that, she sold her violin. Ah, this is the defining moment in her life, I realize. Her amazing career rose to a crescendo, and that breakdown in the library was the encore. A moment when something lost might have been found again, and wasn't. I do a search for the Stradivarius she sold at auction 12 years ago, but the buyer was anonymous. It was a ridiculous dream of hers, an inevitable downfall, because whoever bought that violin would not sell it without global fanfare. She'd have known if it was sold. It would have been in magazines and on the news as one of those general interest stories. She had to know the violin in the library wasn't her Stradivarius when she walked in there. Still, she hoped, didn't she? And felt the loss all over again last night. I sigh for her. So close, and yet not close at all. Gazing up at the monitor, I ask the sleeping girl, "You want it back, Evangeline?" "Not the violin, it's gone. She's never getting that back. Certain things are just not for sale, and that violin is one of them. Even money like mine can't get that back. Not that I would." What a freak fucking thought. She wants herself back. I feel sorry for her. I see her vulnerability splayed out before me like a banner in the wind. I relate to it a little, I guess. The loss, maybe. She lost herself much the way I lost myself all those years ago. And the sadness. But I'm not a sad guy. More indifferent than sad. But I can relate to her. The way she was used. The way she gave up what she loved to find her own way in the world. The courage it must have taken to drag herself over to this house and let a stranger watch her. Why? I press Jordan's contact on my phone. He picks up on the first ring. Yep, he says. Why? I ask. Why what? Why is she here? Why do you care? I just do. There's a prolonged silence after that. I let it hang there. She's got issues, man, and she wants to get past them, that's all. But why now? Jordan sighs long and loud. Don't ask questions, Ix. I don't really have answers anyway, but even if I did, I don't think you need to know. He ends the call after that. Leaves me hanging like the silence I left him in for a few moments before. I set my phone down and watch her. It's my job, right? So I watch her. The way her leg sneaks out from under the covers when she gets hot. The way it slips back under when she's chilled. The way her body occasionally thrashes, like she can't get comfortable. The way she keeps her eyes closed, either asleep and doing all this unconsciously or just squeezing them shut to keep the world away. I have the pen and notebook in my hand almost unconsciously. The pen writes of its own accord. Sharp-edged letters printed out in my own hand run across the page like a horse racing for the finish line. I read it over and over again, then tear the page off, fold it once, and print her name on the front just like I did earlier. I have no second thoughts as I get up, punch in the code, unlock the door, and exit my room. I think of no one but her as I walk across the basement, ignoring the flashing lights of Pac-Man and the digital song of Centipede, and climb the stairs to the main floor. As I walk down the hallway towards the grand foyer, my attention never falters. I don't see the chandeliers or the intricate ceiling of the once ballroom. I take the stairs two at a time, my hand sliding along the smooth banister, and never once compare it to the banister of my childhood. On the second floor, I don't look right, towards the bedrooms of forgotten children. I see only the open stairs that lead up to the master on the left. My feet know where to go. Know to step lightly as I climb once again, hand on the railing, head tilted up, eyes focused on the double doors ahead. I don't even stop when I get to them. Don't hesitate at all. They must open for me like all this was meant to be, because I'm in her room, watching her. Not on the flat screens of my control room, but here, in person. If I care if I wake her, it doesn't show, because my boots are allowed to thud across the hardwood until they land on the soft rug in front of the bed and go silent. There's a moment when I imagine myself leaning down to brush the hair out of her face so I can see the contours of her cheekbone, but that passes. I leave the note on the bedside table and retreat, confident that this is the right way forward. I'm helping her, I decide, making my way down to the second floor. She needs this, just like she needed that last note. She's here for a reason. She wants to get better. She's strong and willful, and none of that has helped her so far. But I can help her. I know it. I see what she needs, and I'm going to give it to her. And she'll accept it because she's practically my prisoner. She'll accept it because she won't be able to stop herself. And when the day comes when she does walk out of this house healed and focused and put back together, it will be because I didn't follow directions. Sleep comes easy when I get back to my room. I strip down to skin, get under the covers, and dream of all the ways I can help her. All the things I can make her do. All the holes I can fill inside her.
Chapter 12. Jordan. What's the deal with you two anyway? I'm sitting with Chella at the courthouse coffee shop grabbing a coffee because she just happened to be here at 8:30 a.m. and I had no good excuse to blow her off since I don't need to be in court for another 30 minutes. I take a sip of my coffee, all casual and shit, and reply, "What's the deal with you and your mom?" Chella's reaction and recovery happen almost simultaneously, but she manages to keep that smile on her face.
She's dead. You know that.
Yeah, and you know that whatever the deal is with Ix and me, it's none of your business. She doesn't miss a beat.
I asked Smith about you.
Smith doesn't even know me.
Brick does.
Brick knows me now, but what you're asking is who was I back then, and Brick didn't know me then either. Don't bother with Quinn, he's got no clue.
So you're proud of this secret past you're keeping from me?
It's not a fucking secret, Chella. It's just none of your business. Don't you have to be at work or something?
You had sex with him, didn't you?
I sigh, roll my eyes.
Oh my God, she says, lowering her voice.
Wow, he's fucking hot, Jordan. I salute you. Shut up, it wasn't even like that. It was like the stuff I did with Brick or Quinn, club stuff.
Okay, Chella says. So who was the girl?
Why do you care?
Chella shrugs. I just think he looks sad, don't you? I mean, I've seen it before. Sadness and I are well acquainted, and he definitely looks sad. Is that why you're helping him?
I'm not helping him. I'm not doing anything. He's just a fucking guy who can run some fucking cameras.
And keep his mouth shut.
I glare at her.
What? It's obvious that whatever you're doing with Lucinda is on the down low, right?
The ding of Chella's phone saves me from answering.
That's Smith, she says, checking her text. He's done with his little permit thing.
I scoff. So you really were here for business?
I told you I was, Mr. Wells, she says, standing up. Come to my tea party next month. It's on Valentine's Day. Ixion's coming.
He is not.
I invited him, so he's coming.
Chella is the only woman I know who seems to think she controls the universe, like she has it on a leash, like her request is a done deal. And it's kind of true. Chella is pure, sweet, considerate, loyal, and honest. I'm sure she has vices, but I've never seen them. So it's like everyone goes out of their way to make her happy. If she invites you to something, you go, because it makes her happy. If she asks for something, you give it to her, just to make her happy. Chella deserves happiness, and the whole world knows this. She leans down to kiss me on the cheek, and in doing so whispers,
I just worry about you, Jordan. You're adrift. Don't float too far away from us.
I stare at her as she straightens up. Exhale loudly.
So, Valentine's Day?
She says, hiking her purse strap onto her shoulder. No, I say, holding fast.
3 o'clock. Don't be late. Ixion can be your date.
She leaves before I can say anything to that last remark. But in her wake, she leaves something behind, too. An air thick with the memories of past regrets and, yes, sadness. It's not like we planned it, not at all. What happened just happened. It was almost a natural progression of things, an inevitable conclusion.
Shall we go up to my place?
Her question lingers in my head like the terror you feel waking up from a too real nightmare. Her voice is clear, like she's standing here next to me, her intent obvious, the promise of something coming evident. I should have said no. None of this would have happened if I had just said no. But Augustine had me from the first time Ixion introduced her. My Augustine, he joked. His Augustine. And where is she now? God, that's the problem, isn't it? And I'm sick. Fucking stuck on a girl who walked out 7 years ago. And she didn't just walk out, she stormed out. Like a raging fucking wind. Upending lives in the process. Friendships severed. Love lost. And then that was it. I didn't plan what happened, and I didn't ask Ix for the favor. Which is the part that makes me feel so shitty. I didn't need to ask. He gave. Just like Chella. He knew what I wanted, what needed to happen, and he gave it to me like a gift, with no expectations of receiving something in return. And I was selfish, because I accepted his gift and gave nothing back in return. I should have said no. At least I wouldn't have lost both of them. Augustine was already on her way out. Ixion was never leaving. At least not until I fucked everything up. We'd still be friends today if I had just owned up to what I did. If I hadn't let him take the fall for me instead. If I hadn't ruined his life and his family and his future. Ixion picks up on the third ring just before it goes to voicemail. What? He asks, irritated, like he's a mind reader and he knows what I was just thinking about. You know, I meant it when I said I was sorry. When did you say you were sorry? Don't be a dick. No, I'm really asking. A couple weeks ago, asshole, when you were in my office. Oh, that? Ix laughs. That's your idea of an apology? Why are you here? You called me here, remember? But why did you come? You know why, he says. Because... What the fuck do you want from me now, Jordan, huh? What more do I need to give you that I haven't already? I'm sorry, I say. You know, I don't know shit. I don't know you, I don't know her, and I don't care either. Liar, I say. Liar! Is this girl a gift or something? What? His question is so inappropriate, so unexpected. I'm at a loss for words. This job, Jordan, is this some kind of gift? No, I say. No, it's just a fucking job. And you couldn't find another guy to sit in this stupid room and watch her? It just had to be me, right? Is that what you're telling yourself? It's just a job, I say again. Is that why I'm here on the anniversary? What? The night you... Stop it, I say. That's not why. I didn't choose this timing. I'm just a guy who fulfills a need, that's all. Yeah. Sounds familiar. Ix, I sigh. Coincidence, then. That 7 years ago tomorrow is the day you fucked up and ruined my life? I didn't. I pinched the space between my eyes, a headache throbbing into existence. Why are you here? I ask again. He takes a breath, like he's about to talk, but the moments drag on in silence. Ix, I say. For you, asshole. Why the fuck do you think I'm here? And then he hangs up on me.
Chapter 13. Evangeline. I awake confused, sweaty, heart racing, panic ready to overtake me, until I remember how I got here. Not here the house, but here the bed. I turn over, looking for cameras. Find them all. Count them up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And for some odd reason it calms me. Just knowing he's there. Just a little. Just enough to fight back the full-fledged attack that would surely be coming if I hadn't been led up to this bedroom last night by his note. God, Evangeline, you're going to feel really stupid if that he is a she. It's not. I can feel him. His gaze on me. His mind a mess of thoughts just like mine. It's his job. He's not infatuated with you. You're just desperate for attention. You're just craving an emotional attachment, so you're inventing a relationship that isn't real. It's something Lucinda might say to me, though she never has. I've had no contact with people other than her in the past year, not in any significant way. I roll my eyes at my own ridiculous assumptions. I'm not infatuated with him either. I just find it comforting that I'm alone, but not. It's like a halfway point, somewhere safe but challenging at the same time. I have a sudden urge to talk to him, say something mundane like, good morning, or how did you sleep? Does he sleep? He must. That has my heart fluttering. What if I wake up in the middle of the night with an urge to leave so powerful I just walk out of the house and he misses it because he's asleep? Which is downright stupid. I had that urge last night, and the problem that prevented me from leaving hasn't changed. I broke my phone in a fit of panic. There's no landline in here. No way to contact anyone. I have no idea where I'm at in the city. I'm unsure of where the nearest public phone might be, and I have no clear plan to get myself home. All those things weren't enough to walk out last night, and they won't be enough tonight either. Even if I do wake up in a panic. I'll just go to the downstairs powder room, if that kind of reaction happens. Just hide away in there until he figures it out and delivers a note with directions on what to do next. That's when I see the note on the bedside table. Not the one from last night, because that was in my palm when I fell asleep, and now it's